Good afternoon. How are you all? And I'm an Aggie, so I need to say for my university, howdy. So I'm gonna cut out a lot of my speech. But first of all, it's great to be back here with David, to be here with David and Frank. We had a great time in October at the Feeding the Planet Summit, and what I love about it, it was engaging the next generation, but not those just at U.S. land grants and agricultural studies, but everyone from across disciplines, so we can come up with innovative, interactive, young minds who will help address this challenge we're all facing. I'm honored to be here today to talk to you about a topic I'm passionate about. I'm actually so passionate. My 40th birthday is coming up in October, and I booked a conference to go talk about biotechnology, and I'm going to actually be with the Golden Rice Group, and my husband was dismayed that I chose to go do this on my 40th and not actually celebrate it, but I'm passionate about it. You as the media are really essential into this messaging, and I thank you for all that you can do, but I'm going to challenge you today to do a little more. Before I start, I like to humanize my grandfather a little. All of you know about him or may know about him. If you don't, you can Google him right now. So I'm not going to get into a lot of his background, but a lot of people didn't know he was actually a human. And I like to show pictures of him. I'm an identical twin. We used to wash his hair and curl it. I don't think he noticed. He would read the whole time. So that's at University of Minnesota, the Borlaug Hall, when he got a building. And I think that's the first time the grandchildren realized maybe he's something. He did come to my graduation at A&M. He flew in from Africa, attended graduation, and flew back out. And then he was there when my son Luke, and it's Luke Borlaug Larson, was born. And he was there when my mom was born. He missed every other birth of his children and his grandchildren and great-grandchildren, but he was there when Luke was born. And the great thing was he was holding him, and he looked at me and he said, "How do you know when they're hungry?" And I said, "It's like a plant. Instead of wilting, he'll cry." So I just like to humanize him a little. I'm honored to work at the Borlaug Institute. We believe that the legacy of my grandfather demands effective partnerships among universities, NGOs, and the private sector and governments. As the Associate Director for External Affairs, I work to strengthen our partnerships with these types of organizations and try to get everyone to collaborate and move the Borlaug legacy forward. As many of you know, my grandfather was the recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize, the Medal of Freedom, and the Congressional Gold Medal. I show this one picture of my grandmother because no one knew she existed, and I like to give her as much credit as my grandfather got. And the other thing is he had never seen all his medals together. So this was in 2006. He's holding the Nobel Peace Prize. The stuff with the ribbons is the Medal of Freedom, and the Congressional is the big gold one. So for all that he attained, he never really looked at these things. So it was the first time we put them all out in front of him, and he got to take pictures with them. As my grandfather had a lifelong passion, as many have talked about, of feeding, as he would say, the hungry and the miserable. He truly was amazing and inspirational, and he never faltered of this lifelong battle. He was many things. He was a teacher, he was a warrior against hunger, but first and foremost, he was a scientist. He often said the fear of change is the greatest obstacle to progress. He came down on the side of innovation and was known for being bold and quick to act. He was a fierce advocate for innovation, technological change, especially when it came to smallholder farmers in developing countries, and he was a huge supporter of the private sector. My grandfather's most potent view of science with man's most advanced knowledge and technology must be used in the battle against hunger and poverty. Upon joining the Borlaug Institute, and I got to work with my grandfather, he sent me on my first trip. I'd spent a lot of time in Latin America, so he sent me to India. And it was my first real introduction into his world. You can tell I'm a city girl, so I was not dressed properly for this farm visit. But I was at the milk villages. If any of you wanted to look at something that was equally as neat as the Green Revolution, look up the White Revolution started by Dr. Kurian in India. Great model. Essentially, all the women come in every morning. They bring their milk, and the children come. It can be in as small of canisters as you see, and they get paid. Depending on the fat content, they get paid right then and there. They have the machines that check the fat content, and then it goes into a cold chain storage. They either get cash right then and there, or it actually goes on a debit system. And we are in rural India. We are in Gujarat, and they have this advanced technology. And they come back in the afternoon, and they only pay the women because we know what men do with the money. Sorry to say that, men. But so they pay the women. And the women use it to feed their children, to take care of their households. They also formed cooperatives. And these cooperatives have a little general fund that they use, and a lot of them use to have little medical facilities or to go back in their children's education. So what this taught me quickly was the story of women, the power of cooperatives, and the power of technology. I then moved on to Chennai and met with Muragrappa and Perry Sugar, and they talked to, and a farmer from their sugar, from the sugar section of their group was there. Perry Sugar had had a lot of problems with transparency with their farmers. The farmers felt they were getting cheated out of the weight of their sugar. So what Perry did is they gave them all cell phones, and when the truck came and picked up the sugar from the farmers, it was date stamped. They had a picture. It would go directly to the farmer. When it got to the plant, they weighed it. They showed a direct picture. I'm sorry, I don't have a picture of this, but they showed a picture of this, sent the SMS to the farmer, and it created transparency. Now, what one of these farmers did was he thought this was a pretty neat system. He could use it for the rural governance of his village. So he broke the Cisco system. By the way, he was illiterate. Broke the system and used it for trash collection, used it for birth records and other things, tsunami warnings, everything that could benefit the village. So what did this teach me? This taught me, again, about the power of technology. So my grandfather, being the constant teacher, was indirectly showing me the power of women, the power of cooperatives, that farmers are not ignorant. Some in developing countries may be illiterate, but they're not ignorant, and farmers are always entrepreneurial. And most importantly, the power of technology. As I've stated, my grandfather strongly believed in technological breakthroughs, and he believed that played the key role in the quantity, quality, and availability of food for the past 50 years. Much like my grandfather's Green Revolution, we have a challenge in front of us, how to feed 9 billion people by 2050. I'm not going to get into all the particulars of that because we all know what that challenge is. But it will require new economic, political policies, new rounds of innovation, and advancements in engineering, medicine, energy, most importantly, agriculture. March 25th will mark my grandfather's 100th birthday. Knowing my grandfather, he would not sit in a room as we retell stories about him. He would be bored, and he would find it too much talk and not enough action. So in honor of his birthday, I have made it my mission to make a call of action, one that involves moving beyond unnecessary arguments over GMOs and the role of innovation and technology to a movement that's inclusive, provides real solutions, and motivates the next generation. Like my grandfather, I strongly, as you can tell, believe in biotechnology and innovation across the board. In my view, though, advocates of biotechnology, so that's all of us in this room, desperately need to do a better job in explaining to the public why biotechnology is so important to our future and why we cannot let the opposition deprive millions of its promise. For years, we in the ag sector have been on the losing end of the argument, in part, I think, because we thought we could win the day with science alone and with scientists doing the talking. Scientists like my grandfather were unfortunately a lot better at doing science than communicating about it. And I like to give the example of my grandfather's simple explanation that he often gave in the public about GMOs. And it went, genetic modification of crops is not some kind of witchcraft. Rather, it's the progressive harnessing of the forces of nature to benefit feeding the human race. The genetic engineering of plants at the molecular level is just another step in humankind's deepening scientific journey into the living genomes. What does that mean? Hell, I read that to my husband, and he was like, obviously, my grandfather didn't have a communications person on his team, but why would you start with a negative? GMOs are not witchcraft. So there's no, I mean, it should be obvious to us why everyone outside of ag is confused and scared. And in the past several years, our arguments to the general public and the anti-science groups have failed. We often provide an alarming warning that we will not be able to feed the population in 2050 without GMOs. and there will be dire consequences. Most of the population doesn't believe this. They feel we're exaggerating. They feel we're doing this for the benefit of big ag. No one in the U.S. believes things will ever be this desperate. After all, food is grown in the grocery store. It's always there, and they've never seen a shortage in their lifetime. So in making these arguments, and in making arguments for the benefits of GMOs, we talk about heat-tolerant crops, and we speak in scientific and agricultural lingo that they're unfamiliar with. By simply saying GMOs have greater tolerance for soil alkalinity, free aluminum, and iron toxicities, we really aren't helping bring the opposition to our side. Now, our opponents, and this is a bumper sticker. It amazes me that you see bumper stickers all over the place. They're anti-GMO. It just amazes me. But our opponents have gained the offensive with arguments that are often more emotional than rational and tangled up with other issues. Opponents have typically evoked their anti-corporate arguments. All these arguments are side issues. They have nothing to do with the benefits of GMO. At best, they resonate because of much of the fuel of the biotechnology critics seem to grow out of the anti-corporate mentality. Whatever source of their opposition to biotech, we need to ask these critics if they really want to bar spectacular, life-saving, and life-changing innovations because of it. I always use the example of the golden rice fields that were recently trashed with protest in the Philippines. And everyone, if you don't know, golden rice is genetically engineered to provide more vitamin A. In Philippines and other parts of Asia, it causes blindness, and 250,000 to 500,000 children a year go blind because of this, and about 2 million deaths occur in Africa and Asia due to this. So my question to these people is, do biotech opponents really want to deny golden rice to those who can so profoundly benefit, and are they willing? And they are indirectly responsible for these children's blindness. I know that sounds like an exaggeration, but they are. And out of their own ignorance, do they want to see 250,000 to 500,000 children go blind because of their ignorance and their hatred, let's say, to big ag? I likewise ask these people, or I just want to know, how many Americans and Europeans who rail against biotechnology have ever been in a farm or to a farm in the U.S. or Europe, let alone sub-Saharan Africa? Have they met with farmers struggling with increasing drought conditions? I wonder how many have actually been to sub-Saharan Africa and seen the women in the fields spending hour after hour pulling weeds. Or losing their crops to insects and viruses with no modern tools, stuck in ancient farming techniques. Not many, I suppose. Once you've seen this, you want to ensure that all have whatever innovation they can possibly need. I think it's obvious. All farmers have the right and option to choose whatever farming technique as long as they're safe. This is not to say, and we've made this mistake, that biotechnology will single-handedly erase hunger, as critics think we in the ag sector believe. But we understand that multifaceted integrated solutions are needed. In short, we know farmers need a lot of tools, and biotechnology is one. So the anti-GMO movement has consumed much of the conversation on agriculture inaccurately and has utilized powerful and clever social media campaigns. Again, these are two bumper stickers. These campaigns are rapidly spread with inaccurate information that really benefit the bottom line of these causes and these corporations, and they cause mass hysteria. Google GMOs right now, and everything anti will come up before anything positive. Furthermore, and I will get to this slide because it's one of my favorite, but we have corporations like Chipotle right now who are creating unnecessary marketing strategies that confuse the public by going GMO-free and are essentially attacking our American farmers. After all, this is not a move based in their fear of GMOs. I know they know GMOs are fine. It's a business decision. It's a bottom-line decision. It's propaganda that creates a niche market that Chipotle hopes it can cash in on. And we need to tell the public that. It's a strategy Whole Foods has used perfectly, and they're doing a great job. So in this picture, we have a GMO corn and an organic, and you realize, of course, the GMO corn is smaller than the organic corn. But what the tagline was that even a squirrel will eat GMO corn. So we were led to believe that the squirrel ate the organic and not the GMO. And this was all over Facebook a few weeks ago. And then we have my favorite taken picture on the shelf at Whole Foods, and this is non-GMO salt. Salt cannot be, by definition, genetically modified, but it's non-GMO free, and it's just like the Atkins diet. Everything that wasn't Atkins, but they could sell themselves as Atkins free back in, what it was, at the early 90s, labeled everything Atkins free. So this is what we have going on. So we have to ask the public and ask ourselves what the world would look like without the innovations of the last 100 to 50 years. And we must engage in new conversations with these fringe groups and hold different conversations that they will understand. I know it sounds bad, but we have to dumb down and shorten our message. One of the biggest mistakes we in the ag sector has made is we never got out in front of this message. So we need to change. So it is time, therefore, to change the paradigm. Scientists, us in the ag sector, and you in the media need to be clear that the debate of GMOs is over, that there is no meaningful discussion within the scientific community about the inherent safety any more than there is about the reality of climate change. And we must remember we're talking to those outside the ag sector who don't understand our verbiage, our lingos, or anything else we use. We're talking to moms who believe everything on Facebook and people who are anti-corporate, except when it comes to their Apple iPhones. And I do often tell them, check the labor records of Apple before you want to come after any ag corporations. But that's a whole other side issue that I will not get into today. I've begun to change my... I'm not an agriculturalist. I'm not a scientist. So I'm kind of a rare bird for these people. And when I make a personal presentation or I engage in casual conversations, whatever it is, with moms, with university students, with the anti-scientists, the environmentalists, I've changed my discussion, and I make it more emotional, and I take it a little more personal. So moms always ask me how I knowingly serve my child GMOs. By the way, I purposely choose tofu that's GMO, and it's getting harder and harder to find tofu that's GMO. But I tell these moms, first of all, there is no such thing as certified organic. There isn't. The standards vary, and a lot of things that are organic utilize harsh chemicals that can be slipped under the organic label. I tell them what GMOs are not, and I think this is important what we need to do. GMOs are not processed food. They do not cause obesity. They are not responsible for the dye in your child's macaroni and cheese. They are not responsible for the sugar level in Lucky Charms. They are not responsible for processed food. You are responsible for giving your child processed foods. But GMOs have nothing to do with this. They're not the hormones or antibiotics in livestock. It's a different issue. I'm not saying I'm against that. But in GMOs, they're not that. And they're not chemicals. They do not cause infertility. They don't cause autism. They don't cause ADHD. They don't cause celiac disease. One of my best friends, I think it was really aimed at me, had an organic dinner party for our children. She used from her organic garden. When she cut in to make the salad, she screamed because the pepper had a worm in it. I simply said, you know, if that was GMO, it probably would be a lot safer than that worm. She served hormone-free milk, and I had to remind her that cows do naturally have hormones. She served for dessert seedless watermelon, and I reminded her that the watermelon didn't just breed out its seeds because it was inconvenient to us. And in the end, she decided that nothing in her garden looked pretty. So none of the peppers looked pretty or the tomatoes looked pretty, and it didn't taste good. So she let the kids pick it, then she threw it away. So that was her organic gardening experience. I think it was a great opportunity for me because I got to refute the entire dinner to a group of women the whole way down. I also explained to moms that natural foods, just because it's labeled natural, aren't always the best. After all, arsenic is natural. Then we have corporate marketing. We have Whole Foods. A new Whole Foods in Dallas just opened up, and I had to go, and they had all their vendors there, and there was a GMO-free meat. My mom was like, don't do it. So I walked over and I said, what do you mean by GMO-free meat? our cattle are not genetically modified. I said, well, that's not possible because it's not legal. There's no genetically modified cattle. You mean you're not feeding your cattle anything that is genetically modified, any feed? No, we are, but our cattle are not genetically modified. Well, and it was flying off the shelf and it was double the price. Well, good for them. But again, it lends to confusion. And then we have Cheerios going GMO-free that just confuse the hell out of every mother. So another group I like to talk to is university students. And Frank was here at this one with me. We were in the Nobel Peace Prize Forum in Minnesota, and it was a liberal, rowdy, rude bunch. Aggie students do not act like this. But in one of my speeches, I talked about our project in Rwanda, and we worked with coffee growers, and we went all the way from planting to marketing. So we did the entire value chain, and we helped grow the coffee sector in Rwanda. One of the students, holding a Starbucks coffee cup, asked me if we forced our farmers to sell coffee into Starbucks. I was like, what are you holding in your hand? And I said, one, we don't force them to sell to Starbucks. They can sell to whoever they want, but they sell to Starbucks because Starbucks pays the most, and it's what gives their brand a lot of recognition. And then she asked, is your coffee fair trade? And I said, yes, it happens to be, but let me tell you what this small farmer cooperative had to pay to get a fair trade label. They had to pay an $1,800 business class ticket for someone from the Netherlands to spend 2 minutes in their field and stamp it fair trade. And then, do you know that they get locked into a price, so if the coffee price goes up on the market, they don't benefit to that because they've been locked in. So there's your fair trade. And a thing that happened at George Washington University at our Feeding the Planet, and I'm not going to use this person's name, but he got up there and talked about how ag is all wrong and how we need to retool and change everything, and he talked about mechanism. And if the Iowa farmers just didn't use tractors, we could bring in all the unemployed people and put them to work, and that would solve a lot of issues. And the students were like, is so right, utopian. That, and I wanted to say, who's paying to get them there? Who's lodging them? Who's paying their insurance? And if a tractor can do it in 1 to 2 days, and it's going to take how many days? But it was an argument that these students ate up. They were like, of course, Iowa farmers are bad because they use tractors. So we're up against that. But then I also, when I'm with the anti-science group and a bunch of others, I just pepper them with questions. What are the consequences of not pursuing science and agriculture? And I go back to, this is agriculture. This is your grandfather's agriculture. This is what's on your bumper sticker. Do you want to go back to this? This is ancient agriculture, but this is what you're forcing people currently in developing countries to use. This is a tractor my grandfather used. Do you know what the emissions were on this? But if you want to roll back 100 to 50, 50 to 100 years, let's go. Then I talk about women in the fields in Africa. Back-breaking labor, hour after hour, unpaid labor, weeding. We can take care of that pretty easily. And how can you be for women's rights and women empowerment in Africa when you're not going to give them the modern tools to move beyond this? It's really enslaving women. There's a picture of pest problems because we can't use any GMO that would help or any chemicals or anything. So there's your corn you're going to be eating. And by the way, the prices are going to go up. Drought-resistant corn. There's corn on your right that was decimated by the heat. There's on your left that is drought-tolerant. So do you want to eat corn? Here we have children spraying in the fields using no mask. I bet they're barefoot. Do you want to move back to this? And you don't like aerial spraying? Well, we can probably move beyond this with GMO technology if you'll let us get there. And then how are we, and back to that, how are we going to reduce chemical use and pesticides without biotechnology? We can do that. How will we effectively conserve water and natural resources? Oh, I passed this. This is urbanization. If people don't know, we've moved off the farm into big cities. But if we need to go back to farming practices of the 1800s and 1900s, we're going to need more land. So this is what's going to happen to our current forest. So again, how do we, I go into more questions, how will we be effective in conserving water without drought-resistant crops or drought-tolerant? How will we fight the dangers and spreadings of crop and animal diseases that will affect human health without innovation and technology? How will we stop deforestation? Because we are going to have to increase the land usage for low production agriculture. And by the way, did you know when we make when we need more cattle for organic fertilizer, it's going to be more greenhouse emissions. And also to feed those cattle, we're going to need more grazing land. So again, we're going to have to plow down more forest. And then I asked questions about UG99, which was my grandfather and late in his life was very passionate about. Are people familiar with it? Do they know wheat forms the mainstay of human food supply today? A fifth of our calories come from wheat. Majority of wheat supply in the U.S. and internationally is susceptible to UG99. If we have a decimated wheat supply, that would mean no bread for your children's sandwich, no pasta for dinner, and no family birthday cakes. And if any wheat is available, the price of everything made of wheat will increase significantly. However, again with biotechnology, if we could develop a GMO wheat that was resistant to this rust, we could lessen fungicides. But you have to be willing to let us get there. This is just a slide. I love to do this with people and talk about going backwards. We can't simply turn back the clock on agriculture and use methods that are developed to feed a much smaller population than our current U.S. population. I tell these people, do not romanticize agriculture or past agrarian systems or simplify the life of the American farmer in the late 1800s, early 1900s, or smallholder farmers in Africa. There's nothing romantic or simple about it. And if you don't realize that, go see it for yourself and come talk to me. Organic farming doesn't seem to be currently working for Africa. Hasn't worked in a long time, but most people would like to condemn them to continue to try this because we don't want to bring innovation and technology and our industrial ag system to Africa. If we're going to go back to ag production of the late 1800s and 1900s, are you aware there's not enough land for every family to produce the crops they're needed? And because you're going to have to be producing your own food, you're not going to be able to educate your children in the way you thought you were. You're not going to be able to be on Facebook and have all your hobbies because you're going to be working in the fields nonstop. And there was a great article, I tweeted it the other day, from BBC Asia about children in India having to go back into the fields and stop their education because they don't get to have modern agriculture. They're weeding and they're picking the cotton and they're losing out on their entire education. So, as you can tell, and you can guess, these groups never have an answer for any of these questions or a solution, but they fall back on their emotional arguments. However, I feel that engaging in some of these questions and thought-provoking conversations, and I always suggest some reading for them, of course, because that would be what my grandfather would want, but I think I'm slowly getting them to open their minds, to go beyond what they're thinking, and changing the dialogue. So I challenge all of you in the room to do the same. To give an emotional argument, to start asking some more common sense questions, even if we have to dumb down our message, and get them to understand the real realities. Don't explain it in scientific terms. They don't care and they don't understand it. I could think of no better way than to end this than to use a quote from my friend Mark Linus. Mark Linus, if many of you know, was an environmentalist, anti-GMO, anti-technology, destroyed all the fields, and then after studying and writing a new book about the environment, realized we have to be in GMOs. You can look him up. You can look at his speech that he gave in Oxford about a year and a half ago. I love Mark. I love what he's doing in agriculture. I love that he is a proponent. He's a great spokesperson because he doesn't benefit from anything that ag corporations or technology or anything's doing. He's just an environmentalist who knows this is what we need to do. And I want to add, I'm not going to read this to you because I know you can all read. But I do want to end that March 25th is my grandfather's 100th birthday. However, on the last day of his life, Bill Ron from Oklahoma State University came to visit him to talk to him about the Green Seeker. The Green Seeker is a handheld device that can be used to check the fertility of the soil, so you can lessen the amount of inputs you're putting on the land, saving farmers money. It can be used at a larger scale. It can be used at a smaller scale. It can be taken to smallholder farmers in developing countries. Bill told my grandfather that they were now moving forward with it. My grandfather had always been supportive of what Bill was doing. My grandfather's last words, many of you have heard this, before he died in response to this was, take it to the farmer. So I challenge all of us here to take our message beyond the farmer, but about the farmer, to the public, so we can finally end this debate. So thank you. Oh, I'm with you now.
Just a couple minutes, because we like to talk to each other, and then open it up to your questions. And I think we got a couple of microphones in the room that we'll be moving around. Is that right? Yes? So I'll turn it to you quickly. We don't have too much time because we have to get to the next panel. Julie will be around. You'll run into her in the hallway. You have no shortage of things to say. A few of them a little controversial.
I'd like to
be at the next dinner party where you take on the mama who's going at the... but there are a couple things you said that really are interesting here. You observed about this food that's flying off the shelves at double the price because it says organic or non-GMO. That says something about consumers,
right?
And we all respond to consumers. So how do you counter that? Are you going to market against organic? You're going to say non-organic and charge quadruple the price and that'll be more expensive and people will buy that?
They probably would. That's a good idea. I'm not against it. I don't do it. I feel like my grandfather might come down from the heavens and strangle me if I was to buy an organic apple. But I say to these people, you want to bar choice of technology, of GMOs, then I should bar you from the choice of organic. So if we're taking choice out, that's my argument. But it's really about choice. Continue to buy your lovely organic food that's no more nutritious, but you have to leave the choice open to anyone to choose what they want.
So you've been spending your whole life doing this, and you carry around this name Borlaug with you. I want to know what you actually say to people when you're up against this, because organic sounds safe, health, wholesome, wonderful. And you're saying, don't worry about these other things that are in your food or you have done to your food. So what has worked?
Well, is it the alfalfa sprouts from Europe a few years ago? Was that what it was that killed people? I love to use that one. That was real safe for organic food. So I like to say, at least in GMOs, we know what's in our food. Organic, because there's no true standard, you don't necessarily know if this is the organic you think. It's not all from a lovely backyard garden. They are from commercial farms. It's not all smallholder farms. I think a lot of these groups say they're a small farming business because that helps them, but they're actually a large corporation. So I do kind of counter the argument. Do you know exactly where these strawberries came from? Do you know what organic chemicals went into them? And I go back to the argument of Whole Foods. I mean, I don't begrudge them for what they're doing. They're doing it great. They're making money, but they're just as capitalistic and forward-thinking as Walmart, as anybody is. They're out there to drive market. They've caused fear and self-doubt, and by going into Whole Foods, you are all of a sudden a better person and wealthier to be in there, and and you're doing something for the environment. So I like to bring it back to this is, if you want to talk about corporate control, you have bought this line.
But the problem is that, or the challenge anyway, is that the conversation that's been built up around organic food has been, the equivalent has been that this is healthier food. And that's both the marketing and it's the common sense that people who don't live on the farm might apply.
You know, I think we've proven that an organic apple is at the same nutritional level as a GMO, conventional apple as it's labeled. So I think, you know, by explaining that, we can move beyond that. I we were talking about this earlier. I don't have a good answer for the question that bites all of us in the end with, how do you know this is going to be safe in 50 years? What if it's not? You know, and my grandfather's response was, nothing is 100% safe? Well, that causes fear. So if any of you have a better answer to that question, where if people fall back and say, we know organic's safe, but we don't know in 10, 15 years that GMOs aren't going to be safe. So I'd love to hear your answer, because I do stumble on that.
Okay, I'm going to go to the question after one more. You just said up here to a room full of journalists, and I'm sensitive to this, change the discussion, dumb it down, be emotional, don't talk science. That doesn't really sound like what journalists are supposed to do, right? What's worked? What article? What do you want people to say and write?
Make it more personal. Make it more about, okay, you're a mom, and you are feeding your child this. Here's why you're doing it. Make an emotional appeal. Great thing, citrus greening, and I know that was kind of discussed here. You can say to a mom, majority of moms feed orange juice to their children every day. Do you know we may not have oranges to produce orange juice if citrus greening becomes as rampant as it is? And do you know the only way we're even beating it right now is heavy chemical use? So if we can do a GMO, you can continue to have your orange juice every day. So just making just simple arguments, staying away from, they don't care what's in the soil and you know, nitrogen fixation. They don't even understand that. So let's stay away from that, because that's scientific scary lingo to them, and just bring it to a more simple conversation. Because I think they perceive us as aggressive when they're really the aggressive ones, but as aggressive and defensive. So if we just change and soften our message, I think that would do a lot.
All right. Let me open for a couple questions from the floor. Here's one right here, if we can bring them up. Hang on one second. Let's see if we can get your mic so everybody in the room can hear you.
I think I can.
All right. That's right.
Is it okay?
There we go.
All right.
Thank you, sir. Could you tell everybody who you are and where you're from?
Okay. Evan Slack Network out west. And anyway, wouldn't it soften the negativity some if we referred more to biotechnology instead of GMOs?
I have moved. I don't like to say GMOs. I just say innovation and technology. I mean, the worst word we used was genetic engineering. If we just could have called it, you know, crop improvement 2.0 or something.
Thank you, Julie.
We could get away from that terminology, I think that would be a good start.
Okay, another question on this side of the room. I don't know if we have a second mic. Yes, it's running toward you.
I'm Ken Root from AgriPulse at the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. Labeling of genetic products, genetic modification, definitely has come to the fore in Washington and California. What's your view on whether or not these products could or should be labeled as GMO or GMO-free?
I understand the public's conclusion that if we're not willing to label, we're hiding something. But I also understand if you're going to force us to label, then you need everyone in food and anything else to do the same. It has been certified safe. It has been FDA and USDA approved. So if you're going to force us to label, it has to be across the board. So I think also if we explain that argument a little more and not, but it is a hard thing to say we're not hiding anything. So then why don't we do it? But I think if we explain, if we're going to do it, everyone's going to have to do it.
Okay, I think we have time for one more right on the aisle here.
Yes, one of my personalities is agriblogger for Zimcom New Media. Question I have is, besides sending billions of dollars worth of food aid overseas to feed the hungry people, what are some real things that we should be doing and could be doing with those kind of financial resources?
This might be a controversial answer to the commodities.
You controversial?
I know, but I'm
going
to go ahead and give it. And it was one my grandfather. Food aid's ridiculous. And first of all, part of the reason why the lobby is so supportive of continuing food aid is the shippers. It is not the farmers. But we're creating dependency. We're gutting their markets when they have grains there. If we went to a cash-based system of aid, like Europe has done, it would build the capacity, it would create their markets, and guess what? Then they're going to want to buy into our products. So I think we do have to change our food aid policies. It's an antiquated policy, and it's time to move forward.
Tried that just this past year in Washington and ran into a buzzsaw.
Yep, no one wants to, you know, go up against that one. But, I mean, I think people need to understand the complexities and why it needs to be changed.
So I listened to you, and we're going to let you go here, and we're going to change gears. But, I was totally relating when you're talking about some of this, because I planted a bunch of fruit trees not long ago, peaches and apples and pears and cherries. It was great. And I was not going to spray anything on them. I was not going to, because it was all going to be organic. I never ate any peaches because they all turned brown and fell off. So they were really pretty trees with nice flowers, but no fruit. Anyway, whatever the message is there, we'll leave it at that. Thank you very much. Really, it's great.